The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Mike Edwards for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Armchair Traveler. And for the next half hour, I will be reading to you from the News and Observer and the New York Times. Now, before we begin our journey on today's Armchair Traveler, please let me remind you that neither the North Carolina Reading Service nor I are endorsing any of the cruises, safaris, tours, or other travel itineraries that might be featured in some of the articles we'll be reading. These are selected simply for your enjoyment and edification. Today on Armchair Traveler, we're going to look at recent explorations designed to help us put humans into space in the coming years, and not just necessarily astronauts. It could be either you or I, possibly, down the road. First, though, we're going to read about NASA Mars lander falls silent after 4 years. This is written by Marcia Dunn of the Associated Press. We have a couple of her articles today, as a matter of fact. This particular article appeared in the December 21st, 2022 online edition of the News and Observer, and the dateline is Cape Canaveral, and there is a NASA image that was released on Monday, December 19th, and this shows NASA's InSight lander on Mars. The lander's power levels have been dwindling for months, reached the caption. And the lander fell silent over the weekend, so goodbye before Christmas. It could be the end of the line for the red, dusty line of NASA's InSight lander, which has fallen silent after 4 years on Mars. The lander's power levels have been dwindling for months because of all the dust coating its solar panels. Ground controllers at California's Jet Propulsion Laboratory knew the end was near, but NASA reported that InSight unexpectedly didn't respond to communications from Earth on Sunday, December 20th. It assumed InSight may have reached the end of its operations, NASA said late Monday, adding that its last communication was Thursday. It's unknown what prompted the change in its energy. The team will keep trying to contact InSight just in case. InSight landed on Mars in 2018 and was the first spacecraft to document a Mars quake. It detected more than 1,300 Mars quakes with its French-built seismometer, including several caused by meteoroid strikes. The most recent Mars quake sensed by InSight earlier this year left the ground shaking for at least 6 hours, according to NASA. The seismometer readings shed light on Mars' interior. And this was the week of December 19th. Scientists revealed that InSight scored another first, capturing a Martian dust devil, not just in pictures, but also sound. In a stroke of luck, the whirling column of dust blew directly over the lander in 2021 when its microphone was on. The lander's other main instrument, however, encountered nothing but trouble. A German digging device meant to measure the temperature of Mars' interior never made it deeper than a couple of feet, well short of the intended 16 feet. NASA declared it dead nearly 2 years ago. InSight recently sent back one last selfie, shared by NASA via Twitter on that particular Monday. "My power's really low, so this may be the last image I can send," the team wrote on InSight's behalf. "Don't worry about me, though. My time here has been both productive and serene. If I can keep talking to my mission team, I will, but I'll be signing off here soon. Thanks for staying with me." NASA still has two active rovers on Mars, Curiosity, roaming the surface since 2012, and Perseverance, which arrived early last year. Perseverance is in the midst of creating a sample depot. The plan is to leave 10 tubes of rock cores on the Martian surface as a backup to samples on the rover itself. NASA plans to bring some of these samples back to Earth in a decade in its longtime search for signs of ancient microscopic life on Mars. Perseverance also has a companion, a mini-helicopter named Ingenuity. It just completed its 37th flight and has now logged more than an hour of Martian flight time. Well, next we're going to read about acing the tests. NASA Orion space capsule safely blazes back from the moon. This article appeared in the December 12, 2022 online edition of the News and Observer, and again was written by Marcia Dunn of the Associated Press. And there was a picture of the splashdown. It says NASA's Orion capsule splashes down to conclude a dramatic 25-day test flight. And this was seen from aboard the USS Portland in the Pacific off Mexico. The mission, by the way, should clear the way for astronauts on the program's next lunar flyby, and that's set for 2024. Now to the main article, Dateline Cape Canaveral, Florida. NASA's Orion capsule made a blisteringly fast return from the moon Sunday, December 11th, parachuting into the Pacific off Mexico to conclude a test flight that should clear the way for astronauts on the next lunar flyby. The incoming capsule hit the atmosphere at Mach 32, or 32 times the speed of sound, and endured reentry temperatures of 5,000 degrees Fahrenheit, that's 2,760 degrees Celsius, before splashing down west of Baja California near Guadalupe Island. A Navy ship quickly moved in to recover the spacecraft and its silent occupants, three test dummies rigged with vibration sensors and radiation monitors. NASA hailed the descent and splashdown as close to perfect as congratulations poured in from Washington. And by the way, there is an update on Orion recently, and we're going to have that in a future episode of Armchair Traveler with more details about what to expect from space travel in the coming year. So be looking for that in a future episode. Getting back to our story, they quote NASA Administrator Bill Nelson, who says, "I'm overwhelmed," as he spoke from Mission Control. He says, "This is an extraordinary day," talking about Orion's return. "It's historic," he said, "because we are now going back into space, deep space, with a new generation." The space agency needed a successful splashdown to stay on track for the next Orion flight around the moon. This is targeted for 2024, with four astronauts who will be revealed early next year. That would be this year, 2023. That would be followed by a two-person lunar landing as early as 2025, and ultimately a sustainable moon base. The long-term plan would be to launch a Mars expedition by the late 2030s. Astronauts last landed on the moon 50 years ago. After touching down on December 11, 1972, Apollo 17's Eugene Cernan and Harrison Smith spent 3 days exploring the ballast of Saros Littrow, the longest stay of the Apollo era. They were the last of the 12 moonwalkers. Orion was the first capsule to visit the moon since then, launching on NASA's new Mega Moon rocket from Kennedy Space Center on November 16th. It was the first flight of NASA's new Artemis moon program, named after Apollo's mythological twin sister. From Tranquility Base to Taurus Littrow to the tranquil waters of the Pacific, the latest chapter of NASA's journey to the moon comes to a close. Orion back on Earth, announced Mission Control commentator Rob Navius. While no one was on the $4 billion test flight, NASA managers were thrilled to pull off the dress rehearsal, especially after so many years of flight delays and busted budgets. Fuel leaks and hurricanes conspired for additional postponements in late summer and fall. In an Apollo throwback, NASA held a splashdown party at Houston's Johnson Space Center on Sunday, with employees and their families gathering to watch the broadcast of Orion's homecoming. Next door, the visitor center threw a bash for the public. Getting Orion back intact after the 25-day flight was NASA's top objective. With a return speed of 25,000 miles per hour, that's 40,000 kilometers per hour, considerably faster than coming in from low Earth orbit, the capsule used a new advanced heat shield never tested before in space flight. To reduce the gravity or G-loads, it dipped into the atmosphere and briefly skipped out, also helping to pinpoint the splashdown area. All that unfolded in spectacular fashion, officials noted, allowing for Orion's safe return. "I don't think any one of us could have imagined a mission this successful," said mission manager Mike Serafin. Further inspections will be conducted once Orion is back at Kennedy's by month's end. If the capsule checks finds nothing amiss, NASA will announce the first lunar crew amid considerable hoopla in early 2023, picking from among the 42 active U.S. astronauts stationed at Houston's Johnson Space Center. "People are anxious, we know that," said Vanessa Weish, Johnson's director, as she told reporters. Adding, Nelson, "the American people, just like with the original seven astronauts in the Mercury days, are going to want to know about these astronauts." The capsule splashed down more than 300 miles, that's 482 kilometers south of the original target zone. Forecasts calling for choppy seas and high wind off the Southern California coast prompted NASA to switch the location. Orion logged 1.4 million miles, or 2.25 million kilometers, as it zoomed to the moon and then entered a wide swooping orbit for nearly a week before the heading home. It came within 80 miles, or 130 kilometers, of the moon twice. At its farthest, the capsule was more than 268,000 miles, or 430,000 kilometers, from Earth. Orion beamed back stunning photos of not only the gray-pitted moon, but also the home planet. As a parting shot, the capsule revealed a crescent Earth, Earthrise, that left the mission team speechless. Nottingham Trent University astronomer Daniel Brown said the flight's many accomplishments illustrate NASA's capability to put astronauts on the next Artemis moonshot. This was the nail-biting end of an amazing and important journey for NASA's Orion spacecraft, Brown said in a statement from England. The moon has never been hotter. Just hours earlier Sunday, a spacecraft rocketed toward the moon from Cape Canaveral. The lunar lander belongs to iSpace, a Tokyo company intent on developing an economy up there. Two U.S. companies, meanwhile, have lunar launchings that will take place this coming year. So there you go. Now we're going to learn about SpaceX by reading Richard Trebo's article, SpaceX Overnight Launch Sends Private Lander NASA Ice Surveyor to Moon. Now, this article was originally written for the Orlando Sentinel and appeared in the December 12, 2022 online edition of the News and Observer. SpaceX was back at the launch pad to send a couple of moon-bound customers into space from Cape Canaveral Space Force Station. A Falcon 9 lifted off at 2:38 a.m. Sunday, December 11th, from Canaveral's Space Launch Complex 40, carrying private Japanese company's iSpace Hakuto R Mission 1 lunar lander, the first of a planned series of landers that, if successful, will make it the first commercial soft landing ever on the moon. Also on board is NASA Jet Propulsion Laboratory's briefcase-sized lunar flashlight that plans to map ice in the permanently shadowed spaces near the moon's south pole. Both were successfully deployed about an hour after liftoff. The booster for the mission flying for the fifth time landed back at CCFS Landing Zone 1, sending a sonic boom in the pre-dawn hours over the space coast. The launch was the 56th for the SpaceX among its three launch sites at Cape Canaveral, Kennedy Space Center, and Vandenberg Space Force Base in California. SpaceX delayed the initial launch attempt last week because of issues with the rocket, but it won't affect the arrival time for the lander on the moon, which is taking the long way around, using the gravity of Earth and the Sun for an assist before a planned touchdown in April 2023, an effort to trade off costly fuel for payload space. The Hakuto R series lander is small, less than 8 feet tall, that will weigh around 750 pounds when it lands, including space, for about 66 pounds of customer cargo. Among its customers hitching a ride are a small rover for the United Arab Emirates and a two-wheeled robot for the Japan Aerospace Exploration Agency. Upon landing, assuming other more direct flights don't make it to the moon first, it would become the first commercial company and the first Japanese spacecraft to land on the moon. The UAE would also be making its first visit with the rover named Rashid that features high resolution and thermal cameras, as well as a probe to study why moon dust is sticky. The venture by iSpace was born out of a previous iteration of that company that was one of five finalists for the $20 million Google Lunar X Prize competition, which ended up not being awarded since no company managed to successfully privately funded landing on the lunar surface by the 2018 deadline. One of those competitors, though, followed through with its attempt and came close in 2019. That's when the Israeli nonprofit company Spacil attempted to land its Bereshit probe on the moon, but it ended up crashing when its main engine failed. The Hakuto R Mission 1 lander looks to avoid a similar fate, and iSpace has two more lunar landing missions already in the works. We have achieved so much in the 6 short years since we first began conceptualizing this project in 2016, said company CEO Katishi Akamata in a press release. To date, only the U.S., Russia, and China have made successful soft landings, while Japan, India, and the European Space Agency have crash-landed probes on the moon. The U.S. is the only country to send humans to the moon, with 12 men walking on its surface during the Apollo missions between 1969 and 1972. The U.S. is looking to return humans to the moon as part of the Artemis program. Just 10 hours after the SpaceX launch, NASA's uncrewed Artemis 1 mission returned to Earth, completing a 25-and-one-half-day lunar mission. A crewed Artemis 2 flight that will also orbit the moon is planned no earlier than May 2024, and a potential crewed return to the moon's surface on Artemis 3 no earlier than 2025. Central to the Artemis program is NASA's hunt for lunar ice on the South Pole, which is where Artemis 3 looks to land. Lunar ice could potentially be converted both into oxygen for breathing and hydrogen for rocket fuel, which could support both a sustained lunar presence and exploration to Mars and beyond. Ahead of that mission, NASA's Lunar Flashlight looks to use near-infrared lasers and an onboard spectrometer for a better look at the potential landing sites near the shadowed craters and other areas of the moon that could have ice deposits. Artemis-related missions are also in the future for iSpace, which is working with U.S.-based company Draper for its future landing missions as part of a contract through NASA's Commercial Lunar Payload Services program. It also has contracts with NASA to recollect lunar regolith as part of other Hakuto-R missions. By the way, regolith is that material when lasers split solid rocks, it becomes loose material, so that's what they call regolith. The company's mission statement is to build out a lunar colony with 1,000 residents by 2040 called Moon Valley and develop the space infrastructure needed to enrich our daily lives on Earth as well as expand our living sphere in space. Wow. Well, we're going to turn our attention from space to the seas now, so let's get back to Earth, and we're going to read about hydrogen-powered ships are coming. How green is your cruise? Now, Marcia Kramer is the writer. Her article appeared in the November 27, 2022 issue of the New York Times, and there was an online update of December 6th, and those updates are included in our article that we'll be reading. And the Just to tell you about this, by the way, we're going to be using the word Caribbean, and then we're also going to Caribbean could be used. And the difference is the British say Caribbean, we say Caribbean. And so, you know, take it either way. We'll just use it as we read it. How's that? Anyway, as cruise companies head into their busiest season, they say they have ambitious plans to curb greenhouse emissions and find cleaner sources of fuel. But critics say the progress is too slow. So let's continue. In the Caribbean, many cruise companies, or Caribbean, I shall say, the British word, many cruise companies have bought islands and turned them into private resorts for the exclusive use of cruise passengers who cavort in enormous wave pools, rush down 135-foot water slides with names like Daredevil's Peak and Zipline across wide beaches. But on Ocean Cay, an island 20 miles south of Bimini that MSC Cruises began leasing from the Bahamian government in 2015, there is no theme park, no giant water slide. Oh, there are plenty of bars, shops, and wave runners, but the general aim is to provide a serene getaway and largely quiet activities, snorkeling, swimming, and lounging on beach chairs, while scientists and students from the University of Miami and Nova Southeastern University in Fort Lauderdale research how to reverse the decline in coral reefs and develop reefs that can withstand climate change. MSC, which has a 100-year lease with the Bahamian government, invested $200 million to transform the island from a barren industrial site that had once been used to mine sand into a 103-acre haven of native plants and trees surrounded by a 64-square-mile marine reserve. The island, according to MSC, is the centerpiece of an overall plan to make the company more sustainable. It is only one among a flurry of plans and initiatives cruise companies have been announcing in recent years as they try to convince the public they are serious about combating climate change. Viking, a luxury line whose passengers tend to be wealthy and college-educated, said it is building ocean ships that will run on hydrogen fuel cells, and investments that its chairman, Torstein Hagen, said will cost the company an additional $40 million per ship. Royal Caribbean Group, a behemoth in the industry, which owns three cruise lines, said it will launch a ship in 2023 that will be equipped with a large-scale hybrid power source, a combination of fuel cells, batteries, and dual-fuel engines that use liquefied natural gas. Virgin Voyages, an adults-only cruise line with four ships, has partnered with three companies working on biofuel solutions, from cooking oil to animal or even human waste, that could power its engines in the future. As the cruise industry continues to recover from the pandemic, addressing climate change and the ways cruising contributes to it has emerged as a major challenge. Industry officials project a full recovery from the pandemic in 2023, and as cruises enter the winter season, typically their busiest time of the year, a survey of 4,000 people showed that demand for cruise holidays was greater than in 2019, according to the Cruise Lines International Association, or CLIA, C-L-I-A, a trade organization. It is a comeback environmental groups said they've been dreading. If you care about the environmental footprint of your vacation, a cruise is not the first vacation I would choose, said Marcy Kiever, director of the Oceans and Vessels Program at Friends of the Earth, an environmental organization that, among other things, grades cruise ships on their green practices. I don't even know if it would be second or third, she said. Cruise ships represents 0.6% of total travel carbon emissions, the least of any sector of the travel industry, and far less than aviation, which represents 17% of carbon emissions, according to the World Travel and Tourism Council. But most cruise companies will rely on heavy fuel oil, a dirty but cheap fuel, to help power the engines of behemoth ships to carry thousands of people around the world. Finding an energy source that will both reduce pollution and greenhouse gases remains the biggest obstacle to the industry reaching a goal CLIA announced in 2021 to reach net carbon or zero carbon emissions by 2050 and, as an intermediate step, reduce emissions by 40% by 2030. This is the biggest challenge that the industry will face in maritime history for sure, said Lyndon Koppel, Vice President of Sustainability at MSC Cruises. Nothing is off the table for us now as we look for new solutions, he said. But the industry's continued reliance on heavy fuel and the plans of many cruise lines to transition to liquefied natural gas, a cleaner, less polluting fossil fuel that also emits methane, a major greenhouse gas, have led to doubts over how serious companies are about fulfilling their pledge. There's a lot of greenwashing, said Zunke Diesner, the transport policy officer at the Nature and Biodiversity Conservation Union in Germany, also called NABU, an environmental organization that studies the industry and ranks cruise companies according to their sustainability plans. If you still burn the most toxic fuel on Earth, he said, it doesn't matter if your customers don't sip drinks from plastic straws. A pact to get to zero. Cruise companies do not get enough credit for the steps they are taking and the improvements they have already made to ships, said Ann Madison, a spokeswoman for CLIA. More than 15% of vessels scheduled to launch in the next 5 years will be equipped with engines that can be powered with fuel cells or batteries. 85% of the ships being built in the next 6 years will be able to plug into shore terminals and use electricity when they are docked rather than having to keep their engines running the entire time they're in port and burning fuel. The commitment is clear, Ms. Madison said. The effort is aggressive. The past is complicated and full of challenges. Among those complications is the pace of technology and the debate among cruise lines over which fuel to use. CLIA has touted liquefied natural gas as a cleaner alternative fossil fuel than heavy fuel that can act as a stopgap until a more sustainable energy source becomes available. But environmental groups said methane, the primary component of natural gas, traps even more heat in the atmosphere than carbon dioxide emitted from heavy fuel. LNG is a totally false solution, said Ms. Kiever of Friends of the Earth. Industry officials say that concerns over methane are antiquated and do not take into consideration technological advancements that have reduced the levels of methane that escape into the atmosphere. Still, said Mr. Diesener of NABU, a better temporary alternative is marine gas oil, which is similar to car diesel but does not carry the methane risk and is far cleaner than heavy fuel oil. Cruise lines are also investing in vessels that can operate on shoreside electricity when they're at port, using berths as plug-in stations instead of running their engines, which emits tons of carbon dioxide. A single cruise ship docked for one day can emit as much diesel exhaust as 34,400 idling tractor trailers, according to an independent analysis verified by the Environmental Protection Agency. But only about 2% of ports worldwide, 29% of them, including 8 in the United States, offer shoreside electricity, Ms. Madison said. 20 more cities and communities are planning to offer shore power, including the Florida Everglades and Miami, but these installations are expensive and they require public-private funding, Ms. Madison said. Royal Caribbean and Carnival Corporation, two of the world's biggest cruise lines, which together own more than 150 ships, announced in November that they would work with the Port of Galveston, Texas, to develop a plug-in station. Cruise lines have also been criticized for their contributions to overtourism, especially when large ships dock in fragile places like Dubrovnik or Venice and send a flood of thousands of passengers aboard overwhelming destinations. When residents of U.S. port towns have voted for restrictions to control the crush of passengers coming into their communities or protect national parks and natural resources, state governments have rolled back their efforts. In 2006, Alaska voters approved the Ocean Ranger program, which used state funds to pay for inspectors to make sure cruise ships going into places like Glacier Bay National Park and Preserve were complying with environmental and health laws. Governor Mike Dunleavy, a Republican, defunded the program in 2019. In November 2020, residents of Key West, Florida, voted to buy a more than 60% margin to restrict the number of cruise passengers allowed in the city to 1,500 per day. But 8 months later, Governor Ron DeSantis reversed the decision when he signed a law that voided any local referendum or initiative that restricts maritime commerce. In both cases, CLIA opposed the local efforts, balking at a proposal to have a tax on cruises to help pay for the Alaska program, and contemplating supporting litigation or legislation that would preempt ship bans like the one in Key West. Ms. Madison said that CLIA did not lobby against the local efforts and that the group and its members cooperate with cruise destinations to support their tourism management needs. The cruise companies should support boater initiatives which are aimed at preserving tourist destinations their passengers want to visit, Ms. Kiever said. Under the current way of doing business, she said, the places that they depend on for their business model are going to disappear. Does greener equal more expensive? Well, below the deck of the MSS World Amundsen, which in 2019 became the first hybrid cruise ship to set sail, are two enormous battery packs, and they're each about 4 yards in length and help power the four-engine vessel, which also relies on marine gas oil. So just a taste of things to come when it comes to cruises, huh? And we'll have more in future episodes of Armchair Travel. For today, my friend, that's the end of our journey. Hope you've enjoyed it and that you'll be with us next time. I'm Mike Edwards, and I've been reading for the North Carolina Reading Service, and I remind you the content of the program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Armchair Traveler is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. That website address, ncreadingservice.org. Now, if you have any comments or questions, please give us a call at 919-832-5138. That number again, 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.